This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, pressure's building on Cricket Australia's leadership to step down after the damning report into the ball tampering scandal. And have we discovered the way people first arrived in Australia thousands of years ago?
The most likely path that people took from mainland Southeast Asia through this island archipelago of sort of the East Indonesian islands that we tend to call Wallacea.
Rescue teams in Indonesia will today resume the search for the black box flight recorder of a Lion Air passenger plane, which crashed on Monday, killing all 189 people on board. Questions are now being asked about the airline's safety record, with five crashes and a long line of serious incidents since the company started 18 years ago. Here's our Indonesia correspondent, David Lipson.
With questions swirling over how a plane just 2 months old that was cleared to fly by engineers could have crashed so soon after takeoff, Indonesia's National Transport Safety Committee is pleading for patience. Give us time to find out why the plane had an accident, said spokesman Oni Wibowo. Give us a chance to have a look at it thoroughly. Give us a chance to find out the root of the problem. Still, the families of 189 people killed when Lion Air flight JT610 ploughed into the sea want answers now. Oni Wibowo says his team needs to access the primary data recorded by the plane's black box. That's our main job, he told the media, and we need to find it real soon. The director of Indonesia's search and rescue agency, Basarnas, says Australia is one of several countries who've offered support in the search. What we have is sufficient enough to conduct this operation, Didi Hamza told the media late yesterday. Bear in mind, he said, this is only the second day. This operation will run for 7 days. Lion Air's incident log makes for frightening reading. In April this year, JT892 veered off the runway after landing in Gorontalo. Its nose gear collapsed. The same month, JT600 to Jambi climbed at excessive speeds, causing a major drop in cabin pressure. Last year, a runway collision and a plane that had to be towed back to the terminal. In recent years, runway overruns, a hard landing and rejected takeoffs. Not to mention the Bali crash in 2013 when the plane ended up in the sea, and the 2004 crash in Surakarta, where 25 people died. Crashes also in 2002 and 2006, where no one died but the planes were written off. Lion Air is part of the Lion Air Group, which operates six different passenger airlines, 110 aircraft in all, running more than 180 routes. Lion Air doesn't operate in Australia, but subsidiaries of the parent company do. Batik Air and Malindo Air are authorised to fly. In a statement, Australia's Civil Aviation Safety Authority said it continues to monitor developments in Indonesia and will carefully assess and act on information relevant to aviation safety. This is David Lipson in Jakarta for AM.
The US President Donald Trump has vowed to end the automatic right to citizenship for children born in the United States to immigrants and non-citizens. The pledge comes just a few days before the country's midterm elections, and many legal experts are questioning whether the move would be legal. For more, I was joined earlier by our North America correspondent, James Glenday, in Washington. James, how is the president saying he can make this change?
He's saying that it can now be done via an executive presidential order, so essentially with a document and a flourish of the pen. His comments are an enormous surprise because curbing immigration has been an issue that the president has campaigned on throughout his presidency and before, in fact, and he's long decried so-called anchor babies coming to the United States. But in this interview with the news outlet Axios, he went further, suggesting that he'd been told by his legal counsel that the changes could be done by executive action, and he hinted that he would get it done as soon as possible.
You can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order. Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And it has to end.
That's U.S. President Donald Trump. And James, is he right? Is this legal?
Well, if the president does do this via an executive order, there's almost certain to be a fierce constitutional debate about the 14th Amendment of the United States, and then probably a legal challenge, or almost certainly a legal challenge as well. The 14th Amendment has been fairly widely interpreted to mean that anyone born on American soil automatically becomes a natural-born citizen. But it hasn't been tested for some time. A number of legal experts have been coming out today expressing the view that Mr. Trump's changes in the way that he's proposed or hinted at would not be constitutional and ultimately struck down by the Supreme Court.
How much of an issue has immigration been in the midterm campaign? Of course, those elections coming up next week.
It's certainly been an issue that a number of Mr. Trump's staunchest supporters in Congress and in the media have been campaigning on quite a lot. There's been a fair bit of commentary about a caravan of migrants coming up towards the US from Central America. A couple of conservative politicians have been out today speaking about what they call a crisis on the southern American border. So it is an issue that particularly some in the Republican Party have been trying to elevate. It's an area where they feel they have an upper hand. And of course, this is a fairly closely fought election, and the Republicans do appear, according to the polls, at risk of perhaps losing control of the House. Despite what the president said there as well, it's important to note, too, that other countries do offer birthright citizenship. Canada is one of them. But a number of other wealthy countries abolished it some time ago. For example, birthright citizenship in Australia was abolished in 1986. It's also been abolished in the United Kingdom as well.
And that's our North America correspondent, James Glenday, in Washington. The federal opposition is making another commitment on education today, promising a calculator to enable parents to find out how much money their child's school will get under its policy. Tanya Plibersek, the Deputy Labor Leader and Shadow Education Minister, joined me earlier. Tanya Plibersek, thanks for joining the program. You're announcing a new funding calculator today so that parents are able to find out how much money their child's school will receive under Labor's model of funding. Are these the true figures or a rough estimate?
Well, they have to be an estimate, Sabra, because we don't have access to the full range of data that the government has. But the numbers are based on the estimated number of students at the school. That data comes from the Parliamentary Library. And then the loadings that school attracts, loadings for socioeconomic disadvantage, the number of Indigenous children, children from non-English speaking background, children with a disability, and the size and the remoteness of the school also feature. So it's an estimate, but it's a pretty accurate estimate of the extra funding that each school will get in the first 3 years of a Labor government.
And how will that be paid for?
Well, we've announced a lot of savings measures already, but we'll be announcing another one today that again closes down tax loopholes that tax-avoiding individuals and multinational companies use. I don't know whether your listeners know, but it's a tax deduction to fly to your tax haven to check on your tax-avoiding investments there. That's just one example of the loophole we'll be closing down today.
So it's additional to the other measures that you've got in place, curbing negative gearing, capital gains tax deductions, lifting the top marginal tax rate, ending cash refunds for excess franking credits and clamping down on trusts.
And you forgot to add the other one, which is limiting the amount you can deduct for managing your tax affairs to $5,000 a year. So as you mentioned, Sabra, there's a whole range of things we're doing because we're prioritising investing in our children's schooling. I mean, Sabra, parents spend a lot of time thinking about their kids' education, sometimes lying awake at night, wondering whether their kids are keeping up with the other kids, whether they're being stimulated enough, whether they've got the right subject selection, whether they're learning the skills and knowledge that will help them get the jobs of the 21st century. We invest a lot of time and thought in our own children's education. Surely it's important that as a nation, as a government, we invest that same sort of priority in our children's education. And if we have to close down tax loopholes to do so, I'm up for that.
All right. The government recently announced $4 billion extra for the Catholic and independent sector. Will a future Labor government honour that commitment as well?
Well, we stood with the Catholics and Independents from day one and said that their funding should not be cut and it should be restored. And we've said that for public schools as well. Well, Sabra, there's two things that I'd like to say about this. We have asked for several briefings.
It's just a straight...
We will honour the commitment to restore every dollar cut from Catholic and independent schools, but we don't know how this money will be distributed. We've asked for briefings from the government. We've received no briefing from the government. And just incidentally, the minister himself has said that this funding may be held hostage subject to negotiations with the states.
It's still not a clear yes or no. We will restore the funding.
We will restore the funding, but we have not seen from the government how they propose to distribute this funding. We can't commit to a funding model, a distribution model that we haven't seen. So the dollars are there. We will restore every dollar cut from Catholic and independent schools. And Sabra, wouldn't it be good if the government would say that they will restore every dollar of the $14 billion they've cut from public schools? That's what's missing here. We stood with Catholic and independent schools from the beginning and said they should not have their funding cut. They should have their funding restored. Why won't the same apply for public schools? Because this government doesn't care about the 2.5 million children who go to public schools in this country, and we stand with them as well.
Sorry, they would probably argue that they've also announced a policy of $28 billion extra for education.
Extra on what? Extra on the $30 billion that the Abbott government tried to cut. I mean, this is ridiculous. They are in total $17 billion short
of where schools would be if Labor's
original funding formula had been followed.
Let's talk about what you're proposing to do.
By when
should parents expect to see a reciprocal improvement in their kids' education attainment for this increased spending?
Well, they already saw the beginnings of an improvement in their children's education with the first tranche of needs-based funding. And then
the Vandals were elected and...
Not only removed the funding, but removed all of the reforms that went with the funding. So for 5 years, we've had no reform agenda.
And my question to you is, when should parents expect to see a reciprocal improvement under Labor's plan?
They should see improvement as soon as new teachers are hired, as soon as new teacher aides are employed in schools, as soon as teachers are able to afford more time with individual students. That's from the beginning of this extra funding flowing. But, Sabra, what's tragic about this is we've had 5 years of wasted time where Christopher Pine came in and said, the reform agenda was just so much red tape.
You've just said when they see extra teachers and aides, but also under the NAPLAN tests, when should parents see or expect by when, 2022, 2025, that they're actually going to see improvements in what their kids are learning at school?
NAPLAN's not the only measure of success in schools, Sabra. It's an important snapshot in time, but parents will tell you that there are many measures of how their kids are performing at school, including being happy to go to school because they're getting the one-on-one attention that they need. So parents will see improvements as soon as extra funds begin to flow, and over time we'll see improvement in test results. But I don't think that should be the only measure that we judge this by. We need gifted and talented kids who are performing great in tests to be able to make the most of their gifts. That won't show up as an improvement in NAPLAN, but it will show up as an improvement in our education system.
Tanya Plibersek, thank you for joining AM this morning.
It's a pleasure.
And that's the Shadow Federal Education Minister, Tanya Plibersek. You're listening to AM, where it's 13 minutes past 8. Mental health groups say the life insurance industry is putting customers at risk by excluding people who've previously sought treatment. New data modelled by the ABC shows the number of Medicare-funded mental health plans rose a staggering 35% in just 4 years, despite the insurance industry continuing to clamp down on claims. Here's National Consumer Affairs reporter Amy Bainbridge.
3 years ago, Tanya Wen's former husband, Barry, took his own life. It's a loss that she and her sons are still struggling to comprehend.
The best way to describe would be as probably one of the most popular, well-liked, well-loved people going, but probably the loneliest soul.
Tanya sought counselling and took medication to cope with her grief, but that had consequences when it came to getting full life insurance cover. Tanya's policy with BT for income protection insurance and life insurance doesn't cover her for any conditions related to her mental health, including stress and anxiety.
Stress, anxiety, that can then lead on to heart attack, stroke, all sorts of different illnesses. And that's the concern, because now I really feel as though I'm paying a lot of money for an insurance policy that I can't guarantee unless I get by bus.
Nick Kerwin from the Financial Services Council, which represents the life insurance industry, says customers who receive a mental health exclusion should consider alternative policies.
Different insurers have different appetites for risk and will offer different terms. So do shop around, and if you're not sure, an advisor will be able to help.
But Tanya, who is a lawyer, says she was told by an insurance broker that no other companies would offer her full cover either. Instead, she told BT the exclusion was unfair. Eventually, the company told her if she doesn't seek further treatment for a 2-year period, her policy exclusions may be lifted.
I was ropeable, absolutely ropeable. I thought, well, hang on, so if I fall into a dark hole and I actually need help, you're almost encouraging me to take the option that I wouldn't want to take and then put more risk to my kids.
BT has told AM,
in the event a customer has a pre-existing condition when they apply for cover, exclusions may apply to the policy, consistent with our underwriting framework, which the customer agrees to. If a customer's circumstances change, we endeavour to reassess the customer's situation.
Deputy CEO of mental health charity Sane Australia, Dr. Michelle Blanchard, says exclusions can discourage people from seeking help.
We've heard a number of stories of people who have sought counselling for their relationships, for grief, perhaps because they've had some challenges in the workplace. And one of the challenges of people facing exclusion on those grounds is that it can deter others from seeking help because they're concerned about what that might mean for their financial future.
The Financial Services Council says the insurance industry's code of practice is being revised and it will serve consumers better.
That's National Consumer Affairs reporter Amy Bainbridge. And if you or anyone you know needs help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. The shoddy practice of banks paying kickbacks to car dealers for arranging car loans for consumers at the highest possible interest rate has been in the sights of the Banking Royal Commission. Those kickbacks are called flex commissions. And the good news is the practice ends today when the corporate regulator ASIC bans it at the close of business this afternoon. It means consumers who take out car yard finance will save thousands of dollars in lower interest payments. Here's the ABC senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Anyone who's bought a new or used car over the decades knows that just agreeing to buy a car is never the final deal. And no one leaves the car yard without being offered finance, known in the industry as flex finance, where unscrupulous dealers have gouged unsuspecting consumers.
The car dealer actually had an ability to select the interest rate that the consumer would pay on the loan. The higher the interest rate, the greater the commission that the car dealer earned.
Michael Sadat is a senior executive at the corporate regulator ASIC, which is banning flex commissions from tomorrow. Having given dealers and banks financing the loans almost a year's notice to end the dodgy practice.
And many consumers would not have been aware that the car dealer had the ability to set the interest rate. Most consumers probably thought that that rate was set by the lender and there was nothing that the car dealer could do to influence that rate.
So basically anyone walking into a car yard over many years have been gouged with this sort of finance. Just how badly have people been ripped off because they don't know how to negotiate or just walk away?
If a consumer bought a $25,000 car and needed a loan for that car, the difference that the consumer would pay if the interest rate was 16% compared to 10% was over $6,000.
The unethical use of flex finance emerged at the Banking Royal Commission back in March. Commissioner Kenneth Hain was unimpressed when Westpac executive Philip Godkin said despite the notice from ASIC, the practice would continue right up until the start of the ban, leaving consumers in the dark.
No information of any sort about this is given to a consumer, is that right?
That's correct.
Gerard Brodie of the Consumer Action Law Network has slammed banks and car dealers for dragging their feet.
It's been disappointing they kept up on this gravy train all the way until
today, I think that tells us that they're putting profits before the interests of their customers.
The use of flex finance has been pretty lucrative for car dealers over the years, but are you worried that now with the ban, they're going to have to try to find something to replace that lost revenue?
Car dealers are, even after this ban is removed, remunerated by commissions. That means that they've got an incentive to make a sale that may not be in your best interest, and that the sneaky and unfair ways that commissions and payments operate.
While banks and car dealers are within the law until midnight, banks could find themselves exposed for maintaining flex commissions at the expense of car buyers who've been ripped off.
That's the ABC senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Some of Australia's most senior current and former judges are going public, calling out a severe lack of government funding for the family court system. They say it means families, particularly children, are suffering because they're being subjected to court delays and costs. Catherine Gregory reports.
Divorce and custody battles can take years to resolve in court, and it takes its toll.
We have one child who has, over that period of time, developed severe anxiety issues and is self-harming.
Brooke, which is not her real name, says she found it extremely difficult to get recognition of her child's needs.
We find when we go to court, the judges are unable to make a decision from the bench on the day. It significantly extends the period of time it takes to resolve issues. It costs a lot of money.
But she sees other families worse off, unable to navigate the increasingly complicated and adversarial system, which is structured to make opponents out of the parents or couple. And those working within it reveal similar criticisms.
So I think that there's just a number of stresses that have occurred in the family law system, in that the number of people going through the system has increased, the matters are becoming more complicated, and yet at the same time we have this underfunding and lack of resourcing that really has meant that families have suffered through the system, as have children.
Zoe Durand is a family lawyer and mediator. Her book, Inside Family Law, includes a series of candid interviews with current and former family court judges, lawyers and people who've used the system. She says most of them believe the court should be a last resort to resolve family and property disputes.
The other issues that were raised were looking at alternate ways that we can resolve disputes in the family law system.
And is this the first time some of these prominent judges have spoken out critical of the system?
Sure. These are the kind of discussions that people generally have had for a long time within the industry, within the field, behind closed doors. So it's about bringing these discussions to everyone, to the public.
One of those talking out is former Federal Circuit Court judge, now barrister, Stephen Scarlett, who wants more government funding for the system.
Well, there aren't too many votes in courts, and that other things are seen by governments as more attractive places to put public money. But the governments have got a responsibility for providing efficient, workable, high-quality court systems.
He also wants to get more matters out of the straight court system.
We need to look at alternative dispute resolution. We need to make greater use of mediation and, I think, greater use of arbitration.
The Attorney General, Christian Porter, says the government's plans to merge the family and federal circuit courts will help reduce the backlog of matters. He also points to recent funding increases to the court system, including boosts to the non-adversarial forums.
Catherine Gregory reporting. Pressure's ramping up on the board of Cricket Australia to stand down after this week's damning report into the ball tampering scandal. The former Australian captain, Ian Chappell, launched a stinging attack on the leadership of the organisation during an interview with the ABC 7:30 program. And now more former players say the ethics report raises serious questions about what needs to be done to improve Australian cricket. Thomas Arredi reports.
Arrogant and controlling, and a machine fine-tuned for the sole purpose of winning. This week's review of Cricket Australia was scathing, and former Australian cricketer Bryce McGain says it's done a lot of damage.
Cricket is on the nose from the public. They're really not pleased with maybe the style of play, maybe the way it is run at the moment. Maybe at the bottom level, there's not enough people really engaged in the game. Certainly Cricket Australia talk about, you know, participation rates and things like that, people sticking with the game. So there are some positives, but there's also some feeling that, oh, cricket, I'm not too sure. I'm not that interested right at the moment.
But he says calls for the board to step down are a little preemptive.
Obviously, it's highlighted a number of issues that it's probably a bit of a failure in the system. It's not just around the performance of the players. So the review's really highlighted a number of things that Cricket Australia can improve on. And I guess the board and the states will need to ensure that they've got the right people to be able to take it forward from there. So I know there's a lot of pressure on the board, but I think the positive is that the Cricket Australia themselves have commissioned this investigation and they've highlighted a number of things. And there's a number of things that they need to work on and they've accepted and they're willing to improve cricket right across the board.
So, I mean, David Peever says he remains proud to be the chairman of Cricket Australia, despite the report. Do you have confidence the board will work to fix that culture?
Well, I think there'll be a lot of people watching and ensuring that certainly happens.
But other former players and administrators are taking a harder line, including former Australian cricket captain Ian Chappell. He's questioned why it was just the players who felt the blow after the ball tampering saga. And in an interview with the ABC 7:30 program, he pointed the finger at Cricket Australia chairman David Peever.
When the fiasco in Cape Town occurred, I said if only three people, being, you know, Smith, Warner and Bancroft, if only three get it in the neck, then it's a joke. Well, I think it's now officially a joke.
According to Ian Chappell, the input from ex-players doesn't seem to matter.
Biggest problem, in my opinion, is that the people on the board, they don't understand the game of cricket at the highest level, you know, how you go about playing and winning at the highest level. They don't understand that. And they don't really want to hear from ex-players.
Rod Marsh is a former Australian wicketkeeper.
I'm not going to say I'd like to see board members sacked or the chairman got rid of, but what I would like to see would be for them to say, OK, we made a mistake, we're responsible, the situation's changed now, let's bring the boys back into the fold.
That's former Australian cricketer Rod Marsh, and Thomas Aretti was our reporter. For a long time, scientists have debated which route the ancestors of Aboriginal people used to come to Australia. Now researchers from the Australian National University say the likely answer is through Indonesia's northern islands. Louise Creeley has the details.
Basically coastal along through here and then crossing.
These researchers from ANU say they've made a kind of treasure map, which they hope could eventually reveal the mystery of how humans first made it to Australian shores tens of thousands of years ago.
Circle all these islands that our modelled route travels through. These islands could potentially have some of these earliest sites that we're still missing.
Shimona Keeley is a PhD student and an associate investigator at the Australian Research Council's Centre of Excellence for Australian Biodiversity and Heritage at ANU. She's also co-lead researcher in the study published today in the Journal of Human Evolution.
We don't have a lot of archaeological evidence. We're sort of trying to find it, but until we do, models are the best way that we can look at these sorts of things. So I've been trying to model the most likely path that people took from mainland Southeast Asia through this island archipelago of sort of the East Indonesian islands.
The modelling of potential pathways took into account factors like the difficulty travelling up slopes, visibility at sea, access to fresh water, and the sophistication of maritime technology at the time. Shimona Keeley says it revealed the likely route was through Indonesia's northern islands into New Guinea and then Australia, rather than the so-called southern route through Timor and onto the northwestern coast of Australia.
For a long time, the southern route has been really favoured. In kind of retrospect, particularly taking into account the results of my model, what we're seeing is that the model actually really, really strongly supports the northern route, and the archaeological evidence doesn't disprove the results of my model because we simply don't have that archaeological evidence yet.
Shimona Keeley hopes using the route as a guide and in collaboration with Indonesian researchers, the team will be able to find sites with excavation potential.
Considering how highly favoured the region is by this model, we're bound to find something, and I really hope, I really hope that we'll find those sort of 60,000 dates. That'd be awesome.
Professor David Lambert is from the Australian Research Centre for Human Evolution at Griffith University. He says the ANU study is a particularly thorough one and backs up gene data of Aboriginal Australia that was published in Nature in 2016.
A whole lot of that genetic data does suggest more to do with the northern route than the southern. So I think, you know, having data which is different, completely different kind of data that coincides with it is rather powerful, I think.
That's Griffith University's Professor David Lambert ending Louise Creeley's report. In finance, Wall Street's ended higher after the US President Donald Trump said he thought a great deal could be struck with China to avert a trade war. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is closed 1.7% stronger, and the Australian dollar is also higher this morning. It's trading at 71 US cents. That is AM for today. I'm Sabra Lane. It's 8:30.